Back together again, as always, you and I wrapping up a busy week, Friday, November 17th, 2023, on Connecticut Today. We analyze the latest Bridgeport election news with former Bridgeport Democratic State Rep. Chris Caruso. We also welcomed Peter J. Lapp, author of Queen of Cuba, an FBI agent's insider account of the spy who evaded detection for 17 years. My next guest, Chris Caruso, is with us right now. Chris, I'm sure you and I both heard Statsiet numerous times growing up, and it was said when necessary, and we got the message, right?
That and many other words, Paul, all part of the Italian lexicon, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So, Chris, we're going to get round three here in Bridgeport, and now it looks like, unless I'm reading this wrong, but I've read three or four stories here, we may get round four no matter what. What's your take on this?
Well, I think you have to do that, Paul, because the judge ordered a new Democratic primary. So first the Democrat has to be chosen in that primary, and then you have to have the final general election, because now you would have a Republican candidate and, you know, independent party candidates as well. So in fairness, it would probably have to follow that course, because the keep in mind, general election on November 7th took place, but it was still, the results were still up in the air because of the Democratic primary that had to be held that the judge ordered. So once the judge ordered a new primary, then there has to be a general election too.
And I guess the Secretary of the State, Stephanie Thomas, said, Chris, the only way that wouldn't happen is if everybody but the winner of the second primary dropped out. And we know that's not going to happen.
Well, even if the second winner dropped out, you know, the judge ordered a new Democratic primary. Mm-hmm. So that's just for the Democratic voters. So how could you say the Democratic voters can determine who the next mayor is? You would have to have the general election where the Republican candidate can run and other parties as well. So I don't know how you get around that. I think there would be a constitutional issue at that point that only one party is going to determine the outcome of the election. So I think there has to be a second general election after this primary on January 23rd. I think the talk is in February would have the second election, and I think you'd have to do that in fairness. Now, granted, it creates confusion and a lot of uncertainty, but in the same vein, you know, once the judge ordered that new Democratic primary, it actually reset the process in many ways. So I don't know how you would get away not having the election. You know, what you have to determine now is who the Democratic candidate is on January 23rd. You know, they put certain safeguards in place dealing with absentees. Mm-hmm. So I think the determination is that the election is going to be fairer. It's going to be monitored. And whoever comes out is the Democratic nominee. Now, the Democratic nominee would go against the Republican nominee and also the other parties, you know, the various parties, independent for the most part, working family and so forth. I think if you don't have that, you're going to have a lawsuit by one of the other parties saying, you know, time out. Where's the fairness in this? You know, on November 7th, you ruled invalid, basically, the results of that election, because you have to do another Democratic primary. You know, I think where the confusion comes in, or frankly, the ridiculousness of this, is that a judge, a superior court judge, the lower court, can't determine a new election. He or she has the right to determine a primary, which this judge did, but the selection of a general election is at the purview of the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court brought it under their jurisdiction. So lower courts can't determine general elections. They can do primaries, but they can't overturn general elections.
Interesting.
So as a result, the judge couldn't say, okay, well, on January 23rd, we're having the Democratic primary, and on such and such a date, we're going to have the general election. So I think it throws a lot of things up in the air, but I believe there most likely will be a general election after the primary on January 23rd.
Now, Chris, we continue to hear, and we're in November already, so we're a couple of months away from the start of the legislature session. And we continue to hear kind of these fractured messages from, frankly, the Democratic majority in Hartford, with some people saying, hey, let's make sure we don't overreact to this or restrict ballot access, which I understand. But then you had Speaker Ritter this week, Chris, saying, hey, you know, the video's out there. I mean, we have to do something. And then former Speaker Joe Arisimowitz was quoted by some outlets saying, no, this is pretty bad. I'm kind of paraphrasing, but he said, no, you cannot not do something with this. What are your thoughts on that?
I think it's right, and I'm happy the speaker did come out and say something, but it was frankly guarded and limited. He didn't go really into detail on what needed to happen. I think he's going to leave that with the committees. I think Chairman Blumenthal, not Rich Blumenthal, but his son, Matthew Blumenthal, is on the GAE committee, and he talked about possible stiffer penalties or fines, you know, people that are found guilty. But I think we've got to look at the entire process. The absentee ballot process is being abused. And thank God, I think they came out with a report a couple of weeks ago that, you know, it's not just Bridgeport, it's not just the cities. It's happening in other communities, maybe not to the same scale or the same, you know, largeness, but it's still occurring in other communities. And I don't know how you're going to carve out in law specific communities like that to say, okay, well, these laws will apply just to Bridgeport and not the other communities.
How does that work? I love the leaders in Hartford, Chris, saying, well, you know, let's keep – well, you know, as I used maybe a crude example, Chris, but I said, well, are you going to say we only tailor, say, the murder or the manslaughter charges in Connecticut only for Bridgeport? No, it's the whole state. Yeah. It's the whole state.
Well, exactly. And then I think they set themselves up legally if the city of Bridgeport wanted to go to court and say that we're being singled out under the legislation, that you can't just carve out particular communities unless, you know, for example, with financial review boards and oversight, that's different, you know, because there's a specific problem that you're trying to address. But it's usually short term. It's not forever. You know, they do that, for example, with certain economic development incentives. Mm-hmm. They say communities over 50,000 and under 20,000, let's say, but that's based on geographic. But you can't say for absentee ballots that, you know, Bridgeport is going to be treated differently and access is going to be more onerous than another part of the community, because then you're disenfranchising the people of Bridgeport. And it wasn't the people of Bridgeport that created the problem. It was greedy, underhanded politicians that did it. So, you know, why should, you know, all the people of Bridgeport be treated differently than other parts of the state? And, you know, the stuff with public access is just a red herring, Paul. That's all that
you.
Is.
Thank you.
You know, and I get so tired of hearing that argument, because it seems to be all it is are politicians making it easier for themselves, in particular incumbent politicians who want to stay in office. So they want to keep the thing going the way it's been going for years, keep the gravy train, you know, well-fueled and keep it going.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, when you talk about access, right now you have wide access to absentee applications. You know, people can get them. They can call in the town clerk. They have people coming to their house asking them, you know, to give them application. There's access to it. You wouldn't be limiting access. What you'd be limiting, frankly, are political operatives from infiltrating the system. That's what you'd be doing, and that's what they don't want to hear. You know, for example, there's no reason why a political operative should be able to take out 100 absentee applications.
Yep.
There's no reason at all, you know, other than that you're trying to do something with this. It was like, you know, the person accused of stuffing the ballot box, and someone said to me, well, you know, maybe it wasn't ballots. I said, well, was she mailing her Christmas cards in a, you know, absentee ballot drop off box? What was it?
I know.
You know, it's like, you know, oblivious to the obvious, and it's like, you know.
As my mother used to say, "Stunad ufa."
yeah, and it's so true, Paul. When you know, they said, "Well, maybe it wasn't ballot Tuesday."
Yeah.
Well, what was she doing? Is she sending The fruitcake for a holiday or something? The
yeah.
nutcake?
Or maybe, Chris, you know, when somebody dies, you send a mass card. Maybe like 200 people die.
Yeah, maybe all at one time. But you know, my mother used to buy all those things and keep them in the house, you know?
Yeah.
I swear she had stock in Hallmark because she sent a card for everything, right?
Chris.
But people don't do that today.
Yeah, Chris, thanks so much. Have a great week. We're off next week. We'll talk to you in a couple. Thanks, Chris.
Okay, take care, Paul.
Okay, bye-bye, yeah. Yeah, she had a bunch of people who passed away, a couple of hundred of them. You know, the mass cards, right? I still get, you know, when my mom and dad died a few years back, I got mass cards. You know, we're having a mass said for your mama, your dad, or your aunt, or your uncle, which is nice. Maybe that's what was going into the ballot boxes. Yeah, can't make it up, kids. All right, back to open phones in just a bit. Chris Caruso on the continuing Bridgeport election mess in about an hour at 5:15. Our next guest retired as an FBI special agent after 22 years with the Bureau, either investigating or managing counterintelligence investigations involving Cuba, Russia, and China. Before that, he served as a police officer, a couple of departments in Pennsylvania. He, along with Kelly Kennedy, have gotten together for the new book, Queen of Cuba, an FBI agent's insider account of the spy who evaded detection for 17 years. And the guest is Peter Lapp. Hey, Peter, it's Paul here at WICC. Good afternoon. How are you?
Hey, Paul, I'm great. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
And thanks, Pete, for coming on. When I got the pitch from your people for this, I said, amen, hallelujah. I am fascinated, Peter. And these are sad chapters, but I've interviewed people over the years who have written about spies and the spy craft. And people like yourself, Peter, I find fascinating, who were on the inside of this and had to track these people down. First of all, just kind of a macro here. Anna Montes, who is she? Who was she and who is she?
So Anna's an American citizen born in Germany because her father was in the military, but of Puerto Rican descent, well-educated, very moral family, the oldest of four children, who grew up in high school in Maryland, but then went to graduate school in D.C. when she met a friend who had a relationship with the Cuban intelligence service already and kind of guided her towards that fateful meeting with Cuba and the Cuban intelligence service in New York in December of 1984.
So just the basics here you give me, Peter, and my audience, sounds like a great story, a good family, a good solid upbringing. We know love and sex can cloud things, but why after this upbringing? Did we ever find that out in the debriefing? Why the turn with the upbringing you outlined here toward what she did?
Yeah, definitely Mr. and Mrs. Montes raised all four children very morally. And two of the other three siblings went on to work in careers loyally in the FBI. Anna had a very dissatisfaction with U.S. foreign policy under President Reagan. We think back to Iran-Contra. You know, the U.S. government was supporting the Contras in the jungles of El Salvador and Nicaragua. And Anna really despised what the U.S. did with Puerto Rico. She still has this opinion. She despises really our country and this interventionist attitude that she would project on the United States and what we were doing in El Salvador and Nicaragua against the Sandinistas, supporting the Contras in a very controversial foreign policy in that day and age under President Reagan.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, this is this was her call to action and really drove her towards, you know, really tragically sacrificing 17 years of her life working at DIA, committing espionage, and then another 22 years of incarceration. I mean, we're talking 39 years of her life that was kind of dedicated to this cause and, you know, in my opinion, frankly, wasted.
And we should explain, if you can, Peter, to my audience, and I know it's in the news a lot, she was employed by the DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency. So in her position, Peter Lapp, at that agency, what kind of info did she have access to?
She really was referred to amongst her peers as the Queen of Cuba. You know, from 1992, when she got onto the Cuban account, she had top shelf classified information with regards to Cuba. I mean, she knew, you know, from a foreign intelligence perspective, you know, what the CIA was doing, what the NSA was doing, what the Department of Defense was doing, what we knew about certain topics, military topics about the Cuban military. And her reach was really dramatic. You know, probably the most sensitive information that she passed to the Cubans that had did not have to do with a human being was a special access program that belonged to the National Reconnaissance Office. We're talking spy satellites, 1997. Just the program of itself, just the existence of the program was classified top secret and compartmented. So it gives you an idea. And I myself, when I found that information, found what she had passed to the Cubans on her computer, I didn't have a need to know. I wasn't read into that program. I had to go to the National Reconnaissance Office and add that clearance to my clearances because I wasn't in a need to know. So it gives you a sense as to what kind of information and intelligence she had and she gave to the Cubans.
You know, Peter, I can imagine. I have a friend who one of whose children, let me just say, works in a need-to-know area. And yeah. She doesn't even tell her mom what she does. She said, Mom, and her mom understands. She kids her about it. And she doesn't tell her mom, her father, her step-parents, her sister, anything. It's like, how's work? Work's good. Okay. And they know to move on. I can imagine for you folks in this line of work, when you hear or see or know that somebody's doing this, I mean, it just... If I was there, the anger in me would be boiling. Talk about that. When people in the intelligence agencies find out that one of their own's a turncoat, what is it like?
We're hard to live with.
Because, I would hope.
I feel bad for our significant others because, you know, we come home from work. You know, I didn't tell my former wife. The entire time we were working the investigation, and I was conducting legal burglaries into her home, and the excitement to this, the adrenaline was incredible. And I couldn't tell my wife at the time until the day before we made the arrest. And I said, honey, I got a big day tomorrow. I'm going to make the arrest of my career.
Wow.
This is why I've been so distracted for the past 10 months. And it is very difficult to live with. I mean, folks that work in the FBI and the CIA and other intelligence agencies, we tend to marry within because we can at least kind of share a little bit of what we do. But, you know, if you're not in the need to know, we're very difficult to live with, quite frankly.
Yeah, I can imagine. At a previous radio job, Peter, I worked with a woman who was very open about the fact that her husband worked at Area 51. But beyond that, that's all he told her. That's it.
Yeah.
Name of the book, The Queen of Cuba, an FBI agent's insider account of the spy who evaded detection for 17 years. So you were investigating this. You were on the inside. Give me a sense of what happened. Like, what was the uh-oh moment, Peter Ladd, when you or some people you were working with said, hey, wait a minute. There's something wrong here. And then what led you to her?
So Steve McCoy and I were partners. And, you know, he received the name Ana Montes from DIA. Frankly, DIA didn't have we didn't think they had a need to know. And they found out about our investigation unbeknownst to us. And it was a major lucky breakthrough. When DIA came to the name with the name to the FBI, we had some reasonable skepticism. I mean, the Cubans went to great lengths to disguise her gender. And we're not talking, you know, fake mustaches and suits, but, you know, they referred to her in encrypted high-frequency messages as Sergio and the name of a man because it would have refined our search much more significantly given the ratio of men versus women in the intelligence community at that time. That was probably the first eureka moment, but we still kept an open mind because we weren't 100% sure. DIA was incredibly confident, but the FBI has to stay reasonably skeptical of information it received from the public or from another government agency. You know, our job is to prove the allegation. And, you know, Richard Jewell, for example, was an individual that the FBI had as a person of interest in the Atlanta bombings in Atlanta, the Olympics. He panned out and didn't flush out. So, I mean, we had to be really careful and cautious. When we got the sales slip in April of 2001 that confirmed that she had purchased a Toshiba Moment, I think that's when Steve and I really knew we had a spy. She was absolutely engaged in, you know, the person we were supposed to be looking for. And now the task turned to, can we catch her in the act of committing espionage? And that was the challenge at that point on.
And let me just clarify something. You said the Eureka Moment in this, or the verification, was a sales slip for something she purchased?
That was the proof that we had the right person. You know, when DIA came to us with a name, you know, obviously that was a lucky break and gave us someone to work against. Okay, let's see if Anna fits the other things that we're looking for, these other, as I call them, tidbits. And she matched most of them. I mean, you know, the ratio of what she matched versus what she didn't match would have got her in the Baseball Hall of Fame. But we need to be absolutely certain. So when that name came to us, it gave us a person to focus on. But Steve and I definitely kept an open mind, and it wasn't until 6 months later that we got that, you know, kind of the OJ, if the glove fits, moment where it's like, oh, we definitely have a spy. She's definitely it. Now let's try and catch her in the act of espionage. That
wow. So she did prison time, and now she's out. Where is she today?
She spent. She was sentenced to 25 years in a plea agreement, and there's a whole lot that goes into a plea agreement and what constitutes, you know, time, but we agreed to 25 years. She served about 22 and a half. She was released this past January. She's living free in a country that she hates, which is the United States. She's living free in Puerto Rico. And, you know, her mother's still alive. She's spending time with her mother. Her mother's, you know, pretty late in her life. And, you know, I think we'll see what happens when mom passes away, because I think that, you know, I can't guarantee that Anna's going to stay in the United States forever, but we'll see. We'll see.
And finally, in about the minute we have left, Peter Alep, how bad was the damage? I know there's always a damage assessment with spy cases. How bad was it with Anna Montes?
I would put her in the same category as Robert Hanton, Aldrich Ames, and John Walker.
Wow. You know,
the modern female version, I can't prove, we can't prove, but I she didn't deny that she probably has blood on her hands. And whether it's American blood, you know, folks that were shot down in the Brothers to the Rescue, and who she cooperated with after the shooting. I'm not saying she pulled the trigger or knew about it beforehand, but she definitely helped them after. And there's a Green Beret who died in El Salvador who, you know, I strongly believe that she was responsible for, or at least partially responsible for. So she's in that upper echelon of the Hanson and the Ames and the Walkers, in my opinion.
Wow. Who's playing you in the movie?
That's a really, really good question. From your lips to God's ears.
Peter Ladd, thank you. Name of the book, Queen of Cuba, an FBI agent's insider account of the spy who evaded detection for 17 years. In hardcover, came out a few days ago, November 14th. Of course, pick it up, Barnes & Noble, Amazon. Good reading, especially with the holidays coming up. Peter J. Lapp, along with Kelly Kennedy, have authored this. Peter, thank you. We appreciate the time, and stay in touch. Thanks, Peter.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Appreciate it. There you go.